You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Good evening and welcome. My name is Colin McClay, and I'm the Managing Director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, on whose behalf I would like to welcome you here on this lovely summer evening and to thank you so much for coming to talk with us about this conversation that we've entitled, and I actually need to look at my notes to see what we've called it because it is so long and unwieldy, Cultivating New Voices, Approaches, and Audiences for National and International Reporting in an Era of Global Interconnectedness and Shrinking News Budgets. As you can see, there was a lot in there. We couldn't agree on everything that we wanted to talk about. In fact, we wanted to talk about all of it. But what we could agree was that these points that mattered so much to each of us very much embodied and extended the work of our dear friend and colleague, Persephone Miel. And that we wanted to conduct this conversation in a way that we felt honored her memory and the things that she cared so much about, and also extended that work into the area that we all care so much about, which is news and information for civic engagement, for social change and social kind of well-being. So this will be a far-reaching conversation, I suspect. We're absolutely thrilled that you're going to take part in it. I wanted to also offer a special welcome to Persephone's family, many of whom are here tonight with us. It's just our great treat to be able to share this celebration of Persephone and this celebration of the work that she cared so much about with you all. So in terms of what we're going to try to do is we have a series of fabulous people lined up to give you sort of little snapshots into the issues here around cultivating new voices in these hard to report in contexts around balancing supply for that news and information, that reporting, that critical reporting that we all need and seek, with the demand to actually consume that information, and ideally even to act on it, something that we find is much more challenging than we would like to think. So we have today a lineup of my colleague Ethan Zuckerman, who recently announced as the director of the Center for Civic Media at the MIT Media Lab, which we're thrilled about. Who's going to begin by framing some of the work that Persephone did at the Berkman Center in particular, and also at interviews before and after her time at Berkman. We're going to hear from Fatima Tlitsova, who is a colleague and friend, a journalist, followed by Fatima, we'll hear from Dele Olojede, another journalist, colleague, and friend. And then finally, we'll have some questions and answers after that. And we'll lead into Ivan to hear about some of the work that he's been doing in Pakistan and from John Sawyer, and to hear about the Pulitzer Fellowship in Persephone's name. So we have a great lineup, and we hope that you will engage with each of these wonderful folks here tonight. Also want to welcome the folks who are not here and now, but online, whether here or later. We know that Persephone's friends and colleagues are scattered all around the world in lovely places, and will be likewise enjoying this evening now or later. I think with that, I've done the needful. We're going to wrap up just by about 7 o'clock with the slideshow and a few words from Tony, and then we'll have a reception outside and continue the evening in a way that I know that Persephone would have loved, with food and drink and conversation among friends. So with that, I want to ask Ethan to come on up.
Well, thank you, Colin, and thanks to everyone for coming, but also big thanks to the Berkman Center for organizing this event and bringing in a lot of folks and making it possible for us to have an evening thinking about some of the work that Persephone Mayle did during her time here and really reflecting on her concerns throughout her entire career working on the future of news and journalism around the world. So I had a chance to work with Persephone when she came to Berkman in 2008. And I know that not everyone in this room knows very much about Berkman or the Fellows Program, so I'm going to try to give you an introduction to this odd sort of institution and this particular chapter in Persephone's life. So Persephone had, at that point, worked for many, many years, more than a dozen years, with Internews, particularly in Russia, working on building independent media, particularly radio, and found herself concerned about the future of journalism and wondering what was ahead of us facing journalism in a digital age, in an increasingly internationalized age, in an age where a lot of the models that we've been using for many, many years for reporting domestically and internationally were breaking down. And so Persephone came to Berkman, which is a very strange sort of institution. It's an institution where I've been formally institutionalized for the last 8 years. My colleagues finally figured out how to get rid of me. They realized that I needed another job, so they found me a place at this little technical college two stops down from here. But during the 8 years that I've been working here, I think I've managed to get a rough feeling for the place. And the place is basically a giant think tank for people in all sorts of different fields who are trying to figure out whether it's true, as my colleague David Weinberger is fond of saying, that the internet changes everything. Maybe. And Persephone was very much coming within that spirit of trying to figure out how the internet and how digital media was going to change the world of international news that she was so passionate about and so concerned with. And what's interesting about Berkman is because it is this sort of super collider for people trying to work in this very broad mandate. The name of the center is the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. And if you can't find a way to make your interests fit in internet and society, you're not trying hard enough. But what this means is that we have people who are working on an incredible range of ideas. We've got people who are behavioral economists trying to figure out whether you can pay people to behave better. We have folk singers trying to figure out the future of how people will make a living in the digital media. And these people are all in the same room together. And the Fellows Program adds to the sort of the core staff of Berkman, the people who are there every day doing research, the faculty who are doing research, and brings in anywhere from 10 to 20 of the brightest, most extraordinary people you're ever going to run into, people who are absolute leaders in their field, very much as Persephone was in the field of international media. And so what this means is every year in September, you go through this very challenging process where you literally sit down in a room and you sort of meet these people you're going to hang out with for the next year, and you try to figure out, do I have anything to say to this person? And what usually happens, or what I've found that I've done, because I've now done this 8 times, is that I now sort of have an algorithm for this. We sort of go around the room, people talk about what they do and what they're interested in, and I find that sort of one of three things happens. The first thing is that someone starts talking and you realize that they're speaking a language you do not speak. And I don't mean this in terms of, you know, I don't speak Russian. I mean this in terms of, this is someone who's coming from a field that's very, very different from my own. I may be very interested in what this person is doing, but to actually have a conversation, I'm going to need someone to actively translate between the two of us. So the second thing that can happen is that you find someone who you understand what they're saying, and immediately you want to pick a fight with them. Immediately, they strike sparks off of you. You want to have an argument. You want to, because this is in many ways the best thing that can happen at Berkman, is to find yourself sort of a worthy conversational opponent. And then the third thing that can happen is that someone starts speaking and you go, thank God you're here. Someone who views the world the way I do. Someone who's got the same questions that I do. And so I've gone through this experience with pretty much everyone who's come in over the last 8 years. But I was thinking about this earlier today, and Persephone is the only person to whom I had all three reactions simultaneously. And I sort of looked at this and I said, well, okay, on the one hand, you're a professional journalist. You're very, very concerned with the future of broadcast journalism, professional high standards journalism, which is not what I do.
For those of you who don't know my work, I do citizen media. I basically look for people who are writing blogs and posting to Twitter, and I try to amplify their voices. And so I found myself immediately sort of saying, I'm not sure we have a language in common. Besides, you're obsessed with Russia and the Caucasus, I'm obsessed with Africa, how are we going to talk to one another? And then the second reaction was almost immediately the sparks flying reaction. Oh, a serious journalist. Okay, one of those. All right, a pro, a professional. Someone who, in fact, focuses on journalism training, on ensuring that people around the world are able to do journalism at their highest standards. Standards, huh? You know, let's argue about what's going to happen in the world of civic media. And then what happened almost immediately as we started talking together was a realization that we shared one basic question. And that one basic question was enough that we were going to be able to work together as long as we had the chance to work together, which unfortunately was not long enough. But that basic question was this: in a world that is increasingly interconnected, in a world where our actions increasingly have impact and meaning on people all over the world, and people's actions from all over the world have meaning and impact on us, why don't we hear very much about the rest of the world? And when you frame it that way, it's an ugly question. It's sort of a confrontational civic involvement question. Why aren't we hearing more about the Caucasus? Why aren't we hearing more about Nigeria? Why aren't we hearing about other corners of the globe that we know we should be paying attention to, but we don't always pay attention to? But there's another way to phrase that question. And when I heard Persephone phrase that question, it was much more in this second framing. And the second framing was, in a world that is this fascinating and this interesting and this complicated and this wonderful, why would anyone spend all their time focused on one little corner of it? And they're two sides of the same question. That question of how do you find a way to pay attention to all the complexity, the political, the economic, the security complexity of the world, and this question of how do you possibly find the tools to enjoy and encounter and learn from everything that's wonderful and complicated and stimulating and provocative all throughout the world? I think of the same question. I think when you put those pieces of the questions together, when it's no longer just about obligation, when it's about opportunity, when it's about that chance to learn from people who may be halfway across the world, but may have precisely the idea or the insight or the story that you need to help stimulate your thinking. How does that change how we think about media? So I should probably say that Persephone didn't come to Berkman just to argue with me, although that would have been great. And you know, selfishly, I would have been very, very happy about that. She came to work on a fairly massive piece of research. And let me just pull up the page for it, because I don't know that we always get to pay enough attention to it. Amr, do you know where it is? You said it was the first tab? I have no idea where the first tab would be at this point. Here we go. So Media Republic was this sort of vast overview of what was happening to media in the US, but really all over the world, as we were sort of confronting this different landscape of digital media and its influence on journalism. And Persephone organized the whole project, wrote sort of the key overview paper with Rob Farris, but also sort of ran horde over a group of us who contributed chapters to this. And in fact, we've got a number of people in this room. And if I could just, if you contributed to this report, if you could just stand up, please, it'd be great. So Colin McClay, John Kelly, Rob Farris, Dan Gilmore, Tom Stites. Whether or not you know these guys, generally speaking, they get standing ovations when they stand up in a room. These are some of the leading lights in figuring out where journalism is going in the 21st century. And Persephone worked really closely with everybody on this team to sort of think through both a careful and, I have to say, very skeptical analysis of what we were facing with the opportunities and the challenges of digital news. I've just had the opportunity, I've just spent, you know, a chunk of the last week sort of reading back on this report, and I have to say, so much has happened in the last 3 or 4 years that when you open a report like this, you're always sort of terrified. You know, so I am an egomaniacal enough scholar that I started with my paper and sort of, you know, picked it up and said, oh my God, do I have things in this that I regret? And I do. But then I went on to read Persephone and Rob's overview. And it holds up remarkably well. And it holds up remarkably well despite some sort of massive shifts in recent history. If you sort of think about what's happened as far as how we think about the changing nature of journalism in a digital age, there are some amazing recent milestones. Obviously, the Arab Spring has really changed how we think about how people document their own movements and how people document their own actions and how we deal with these citizen voices that Persephone was very much talking about, and talking about a lot of the questions that have dominated our discourse right now. Credibility, filtering. Who do we know who to listen to? How do we know how to take this seriously? We recognize the legitimacy of these voices, but we also need to know how we can trust them, how we can verify them, how we can triangulate and sort of figure out where they're coming from. Going back a year before that, the Green Revolution in Iran, which opened up some really interesting questions for all media scholars about this question of what does it mean to participate in somebody else's events? What does it mean to be involved with a movement that's going on in another part of the world? The Green Revolution was this sort of invitation for people to essentially make themselves part of the movement, whether or not they were Iranian. How does that involvement change how we think about reporting and how journalism gets done? Even before the alleged Moldova Twitter revolution, which has really shaped how we think about how we get accounts from the ground. And what was wonderful about going back to this is that all the questions that I'm watching journalism scholars ask are questions that she was asking. And she was asking them from the perspective of someone who has been helping reporters in some of the most challenging environments around the world for decades, and literally trying to figure out how do you go through this incredibly difficult work of letting someone whose life is under threat for their reporting get their story out while thinking really, really seriously about the other aspects of this. How do you know whether this is true? How do you verify this? How do you make sure that we're not just telling the story, but that the story is coming to life for an audience in one fashion or another? And what I found most encouraging in reading back on this report was that I think she hit the real problem on the head, which is that the problem isn't just making it possible for more people to speak. One of the things that she ends up saying early on in this report, and now as I say it, I have scrolled past it. One of the things she says early on in this report is new tools make it easy to create digital media, but ensuring that content reaches the public it needs is an ongoing challenge. Various intermediaries can create ways to reach populations that lack the time, motivation, or skills to participate in actively shaping their own news agendas that could have an enormous effect on the reach and effectiveness of public interest media, in effect bringing the news to people. So for me, this is the core of the questions that I found Persephone asking, both in her time at Berkman, and really as I think about it, a lot of her time at Internews, and as she returned back to Internews to work on issues of internet freedom. It's not just about increasing the supply of news. We've all thought about some of these issues of how difficult it is to report from some of these places around the world. But when someone takes an incredible risk to get out an important story, how do we ensure that there's also demand for that story? We can't just crank up the supply if there's no one working on the demand side of this. And what was really extraordinary about Persephone's vision with this is not only was she thinking about both sides of this equation, not only was she thinking very skeptically about the fact that digital media was going to increase the supply, she was a firm, optimistic believer that we could somehow do better. Many serious journalists, professional journalists, look at digital media, and the first thing they're concerned about is how do you ensure that we don't lose the old? How do we make sure that we don't lose the serious investigative journalism that we've done in the past? And you can find that all throughout Persephone's paper. She's terribly, terribly worried about that. But she's also deeply cognizant of the fact that a lot of these media systems from an earlier broadcast age did not do a very good job of reporting on places like Chechnya and getting people in America news from places like Nigeria. And that even if there was a supply of that news, it wasn't being presented or shaped for people in ways where they were demanding it and they were taking more of it and they were asking more of it. And I remember arguing with Persephone about this and saying, should we really be focusing on doing more reporting from the developing world if people aren't paying any attention to it, if they're not asking for it? And she said, maybe we've just never done it very well. And I don't think that's just pure naive optimism. I think that's actually a fairly deep reflection on what changes in a digital age. When you're doing very serious reporting in a digital age, you have the possibility of telling a story at different depths. You can give the short version for the person who might not know anything about it but wants to get more into it, and then you have the ability to go much deeper. You have the ability to layer on image and video and bring people into stories in ways that are much, much harder to do purely in a print age. You can go very long, you can go very short, and you can bring an actual interaction into this. You can make it possible for people to have an ongoing conversation with the people who are being written about and to have that deep human connection behind it. The hope is that as we learn to use what digital media is really good at, we can work not just on the supply problem, but on the demand problem. We can work at presenting the sort of compelling international stories that we really need to know about if we're going to be actors in the world, but we can be motivated not by that desire to eat our media broccoli, but to actually encounter what's most fascinating out there in the world. And so the people that we've brought together today are some of the people who I think are doing some of the most fascinating work in trying to figure out not just how to report from very difficult and very challenging places, not just how to report under threat, but how to report and how to share stories in a way that makes it possible for you, even if you've never heard or thought about the places that they're coming from, and get very, very deeply involved with that. And I should mention that Persephone had something that's quite rare, which is the opportunity to think through how she wanted to be remembered and memorialized by the people who loved her and cared about her. And her decision was to set up a fellowship to make it possible for more of these extraordinary journalists to be able to tell these stories, not just within their own countries, but to come here to the United States and share these stories with a broader audience. And with that in mind, I wanted to turn the mic over first and foremost to Fatima Tslisova, who is really the exemplar of the person telling these sorts of stories that we rarely hear and desperately need to hear. Fatima comes from the Northern Caucasus, has been deeply involved with independent media in Russia for many, many years. And I know from talking to Persephone about this is the personal inspiration for Persephone asking to be remembered in this fashion. And really the example for the wonderful fellowship administered by the Pulitzer Center. So we can really think of no more appropriate way than asking her not just to talk about Persephone, but maybe more importantly, her work and the stories that Persephone wanted to make sure that we would hear. So please, Fatima.
To be here, first of all, to represent the whole army of very professional and courageous journalists all around the world who were friends of Persephone, whom Persephone supported, loved, and who still remember her and will be remembering her in the years to come. And again, it's an honor to be here and to honor Persephone. I was asked to talk about the job I do and why it is important to deliver the message from people like me. I just need to tell you that I came from a very small village in the mountains in the North Caucasus. North Caucasus is a place which is known for violence for many, many years, more than 100 years. My village is not in Chechnya. Chechnya is known as the place where there's a war going on for last 20 years, but I came from the place which is considered to be a peaceful part of the Caucasus. But my experience is very different from what you can get from Russian media and the general opinion. So I wanted to sit down to show you some just examples. I was asked today to talk the job I'm doing. So this is some pieces I have written during the years, the examples of what is going on there. First of all, I'm going to start with the interview I conducted a month ago with a prominent Russian journalist. His name is Grigory Shvedov. His agency is concentrated mostly on the North Caucasus. Grigory Shvedov told me very interesting things. I asked him why he thinks it is important to report from the North Caucasus. He said, "My audience is not the people of the North Caucasus. I don't have to tell them about their lives. They live those lives. My audience is the Western audience. I need to deliver this message." I asked him why. Why the West should be interested in your message? And he said, "Because it needs to be stopped. Because people should know what is going on there, on the place." Now let me turn to the reporting that for over the last 10 years, I was reporting on torture, kidnappings, and torture in Russian prisoners. A report from 2004. This is a story of a man who was kidnapped, a young man who was kidnapped from the street in the city of Nalchik. After 4 days, his body was found in the trash in a suburban area. And the medical exam showed that all his internal organs were destroyed. It was like he was pushed through the mixer. He died the same day. This story was never reported by the Russian media except for Novaya Gazeta, where I was working at that time. So this is one of the stories that Russian media, mainstream media, was never covered, and that is the local voices that can tell those stories. This story was in 2008. These people wrote a letter to me, letters actually. You can see those examples, handwritten letters. If you read them, some of the details, you can't even publish them. We had to edit the letters because the details of torture were so horrible. So the editor decided to censor it, just to cut off some pieces of those letters. So the first I showed you was in 2004. This one is in 2008. You can see the pictures. This is an official picture from his case, from this man's case. You can see the electrical torture, all this, and he holds this tag with his name on it, his date of birth, and the case number. This was, again, 2008. And let's go to the current situation. Here, this is written actually in April. Absolutely the same situation, torture in the Caucasus, in the prisons, so it never stopped. Very few Russian media report on this issue, and people suffer in hundreds and thousands all around Russian prisons. And even though we tell this story, there is no reaction from the Russian government, there is no reaction, almost no reaction from the society. Very few human rights activists report on this. They try to bring attention to these cases, but they are so marginalized by the government, so they don't, their voices are still unheard. That is why I think the attention from the Western audience is needed. This is the first case. Another case, of course, again, the same stories that are actually going on in Russia. What you can't see in Russian media. Let's go to corruption. This story I wrote again in April. This is the house built for Ramzan Kadyrov. He is the president of the Chechen Republic. This is the story of you know, the houses the officials live in, their cars, and what they actually earn. Officially, their salary, the official salary, is no more than $5,000. But for example, Ramzan Kadyrov, this is the video from internet, so people just film it on their mobile phones, and this is the pride of Ramzan Kadyrov, his cars. This man officially earns $5,000, and it is only his cars, but you can see also his houses and all that stuff. So this is so obvious how much corruption is there on the very horizontal, let's say, level. But there is another type of corruption. This story is about corruption under the cover of counterterrorism operation. Russia adopted not that long ago, about 2 years ago, adopted a new law called the Law on Counterterrorism Operation. When they announce a place as a place of the counterterrorism operation, it is closed for the media. No journalist can access to that place. There is a restriction for movement. People are obliged to stay in their houses, and the police or other secret forces can come to their houses, arrest anyone, and they actually kill a lot of people. But the most important thing about this law is that when there is a counterterrorism operation zone announced, all the businesses that are connected to the government, all the business projects are free from taxes. So this story is about one particular place, a recreational zone in the mountains, which is announced as a counterterrorism zone, and then next day the head of the government of that place announced that they're going to invest $15 billion in the recreational zone. So that is how the money are stolen from the budget and going to different, you know, private pockets. Again, this story was never told in Russian media. I wonder many times what is unprofessionalism or the agenda that runs most of the mainstream media in Russia. This story is about transformation of the news. When the Forbes announced the 10 most wanted terrorists around the world, suddenly in Russian media, in mainstream media, the story turned out to be that it was the FBI who announced the 10 most wanted terrorists, not the Forbes. there is, I think, a difference between Forbes and FBI. But anyway, that difference, you can see the screenshot of the FBI website, and here is the screenshot of Forbes, and here is the screenshot of some of the Russian media. So they just transformed the news, and no one ever cared to go to the website and check out the facts. Sometimes I think it's just the agenda. And talking about agendas, and you can always think that you get more or less objective picture from the Russian media. Let's go to Russia today. I represent an ethnic minority, the Circassians. My people were killed and deported in 19th century from our homeland and are scattered all around the globe. We have only 3% of our people living in homeland and 97% living abroad in diasporas. So this is a Russia Today video representing how my people live in homeland. Of course, it is staged. It represents, we used to be pagans for, you know, until very recently, so this is a pagan ritual when they pray to the trees, like druids. Wherever you see the Russian media, you will see dancing, you will see happy people singing, whatever. But look what is behind all those stories. Also, the story which was never told by Russian media, I visited this man during my trip in the Caucasus. This is a retired man. He is also a Circassian. And he went to the street holding a sign, a handwritten sign, why you have deported, killed and deported my beautiful noble people. For that, for this sign, he was beaten up by the people from the FSB, taken to the custody, kept for 4 hours. They broke his shoulder. Afterwards, that was just a simple, you know, action. He never said any word. He was just staying there holding this sign. That was all. But afterwards, he went to the court. He wrote a claim against FSB, which is the most powerful, organization or institution in Russia, as you know. It's a descendant of KGB. So he went to the court against FSB. The local court, of course, and the High Court of Russia decided that there was no damage done to him. They ignored all the medical records, and now he went to the European Court. After his case was taken, you know, accepted by the European Court, the FSB man came to him and recommended him very softly to take back his application, his claim from the European Court. This man, showed him the door, and he never took his case off, but after that visit he was... he appeared in emergency room with heart attack. So this is the story of how the Russian government handles all the initiatives, even the most peaceful initiatives, especially in the regions like the one I came from, the North Caucasus. And the cover-up, you can... show all those nice dances and pictures, but it doesn't change the reality. The media in Russia, unfortunately, does not give you the picture of real life of people. And in order to get that picture, you need to listen to the local voices. That was the opportunity given to me by, with the help of Persephone, by the Pulitzer Center. I was able to go back to the Caucasus and conduct interviews and tell the stories that were never told before, and even analyze the types of censorship used by the Russian government against journalists like myself, who tried to raise their voices against the system, who just, you know, tried to do their duty to tell the story. This is very important for people who live in the Caucasus. They really believe in democracy, and they look at the Western countries as the role model. They are waiting for some kind of engagement, help, and recognition of the suffering they are going through. And Persephone was one of the very few people who was ready to listen, ready to help, and ready to create an auditory who need to hear these voices. So on that note, let me finish my story. Thank you very much, and I'm sorry for my English. It's still.
So now we move from that story of the challenge of telling these at times harrowing tales from what's happening around the world to Delia Legere, who came as a young man to the United States to report at Newsday, New York Newsday, rose to become the foreign editor, where he reported from something like 50-odd countries, and at the perhaps what we might have thought of the apex of his career, left Newsday and went back to Nigeria, his native Nigeria, where he began Next, a newspaper and 234 Next website, and began to take on at an institutional level some of these challenges that we've just heard from Fatima, to try to tell the truth, the Nigerian hard truth, in an atmosphere which is very difficult to report in, and where in other media outlets perhaps we're leaving something to be desired. He went on to win a Pulitzer Prize for his work at Newsday, oddly enough, after he'd returned to Nigeria. And I'm also pleased to note that he's now the International Advisory Council Chair for the Global Network Initiative, which is something that we work on at Berkman, and that Persephone also worked on in her capacity at Internews. So with that, Delia, please come up.
Thank you for not considering this a complete waste of time. We will try to make it worth your while. Perhaps here, a measure of the truth is better appreciated among the top 1%, to which you all belong in some fashion or the other. I was just in Aspen the last few days moderating some seminars on leadership, and one of the pieces we read was, I think, Stiglitz's piece in the Atlantic about what he considers the new U.S. system of for the 1% by the 1% and so on. So this 1%, or shall we say 0.01% in Nigeria, you're lucky to have 1% here, the 0.01% in Nigeria sits atop a vast pool of oil and gas, which has managed to poison everything, including the values with which we were raised when I was a young fellow in the 60s and 70s in my country. And so I became a young reporter in Lagos some 30-odd years ago, and it was a very exciting time for people such as myself. We were really probably my set that came into newsrooms across the city around 1981, 1982, we were the only ones who were almost uniformly with a college degree. Up until that time, Nigerian newsrooms were stocked with people who rose through the ranks as janitors and drivers and so on. So the city editor looks around, there's an assignment, and there's no reporter around, and the porter is there. And he says, okay, you go cover that story. So it began to change by the time people like me got into newsrooms. And so we were, of course, quite idealistic. We thought we were masters of the universe, and we were going to take control of our country and make sure things were done the right way. Of course, that lasted only about 6 years. My editor was killed by a letter bomb on a Sunday morning, October 19, 1986. In my intemperate outburst, I stated that we had sufficient evidence to implicate the then military dictator in the killing, which meant that by Monday morning we were already shut down. One thing led to the other. And I rather unceremoniously left the country a few months later. It was supposedly to go take a sabbatical at Columbia University, get a master's degree, cool down, assume some wisdom from age, and then go back in there. But of course, the story turned out differently. I couldn't go back immediately. I was recruited from there by Newsday and became a foreign correspondent in the Hamptons off Long Island. It was a very exciting time for me. So anyway, my career took all these turns, and in many ways I got lots of opportunities to do things. And one day I looked up on the wall and saw the clock was winding down, and I decided it was time to go home and go see what one could do to help advance a society that had been so hard done by its elites, the 0.01% that I referred to earlier. And so the idea of Next was to create a new news organization in a place that is so thoroughly and perhaps irredeemably corrupted in its values, just as it's physically corrupted by oil. And the idea was that we would create a honest space in this environment where credible news and informed opinion would serve as weapons for citizens to use in making good decisions as citizens, and that we hope that that way we will be able to advance the needle a little bit, or at least deny people the excuse that they didn't know. We wanted to make sure that everybody knew what was going on. Now, I have to confess that if I knew how hard it was going to be, there was absolutely no chance that I would have contemplated this, let alone go back there to try and tackle it. The age was wrong. I'm now 50 years old. This is what you do when you're 35 and 28 and 30 years old max. So I see a lot of young people in the room. You better just do it now and not wait until you're 50 years old. So we began to really, we began to tackle a lot of these issues. And this is virgin territory, literally, because we didn't even have to do any work except just be honest. And so things came our way, and we began to publish a lot of quite extraordinary stories about what our leaders were up to in politics and business, which, as in many countries, formed a grand alliance that has proved inseparable despite our best efforts. Occasionally, a story that we would do will result in something rather grand, and we say, oh, yeah, we can do this. It gets interesting. I've collected lots of young people, spent lots of time and money on them, training them, firing them up, and working together to try and make this dent in the many challenges that face the country. And so the establishment was rather puzzled by us. They didn't really know what we were about, because it seemed rather foolish, if not suicidal, to be doing these things. And so with some bemusement, they began to watch us, and essentially to try and figure out how are these people going to survive. So we became an object of great fascination for the same people that we were causing all these discomforts. You remember, they're so overwhelmingly powerful, so wealthy, and so thoroughly bought the entire place that we were not really so much a threat initially as an object of bemusement. And but then things started, the temperature started rising a little bit. We started doing stories about the banking system and the really venal culture that had developed there, which was rather dramatically exposed at the end of 2008 when the whole thing came crashing down. And we started finding stories about even the maid to one of the banking chiefs being given billions of dollars in loans, of course, as a front, with no intention of ever repaying things. So people's pensions and so on all went down the tubes. Some of them did manage to get jailed, but for 6 months or thereabouts, and were released apparently for good behavior or something. As this happened, one thing became very clear to us, that we were going to be, the first attempt is that we were going to be befriended. If we were not going to be friends, then there was going to be an attempt to bribe us. If we were not going to take bribes, then there would be some other means of squeezing us. A denial of business came very quickly. We could not get a page of advertising if we offered an arm and a leg for it. This was rather dramatically illustrated for us one day. We were publishing a story about one of the richest business people in Nigeria, who was the heavy in telecoms and in banking and in the oil and gas sector. But it turns out the guy absolutely believed in paying no taxes. I mean, this would not be strange to many of you in the room, that a rich guy doesn't want to pay taxes. But this was actually an extreme case of that. He just refused to pay anything and would rather bribe tax authorities to leave him alone, which he'd done successfully for a while, until the head of the tax agency, one day, maybe a flash of inspiration, maybe he was converted, she was converted by a pastor or something, but decided she was going to look into this man's empire. And she didn't have to look too long, because they found a tax filing from this man's conglomerate that admitted to owing about $1.5 billion in unpaid taxes over 5 years. This was unaudited. This is what just he admitted to. And so the tax authorities tried to negotiate with him. He wouldn't pay, so they went one day and shut down his headquarters building and then issued a press statement saying, "We, the Internal Revenue Service," that's the equivalent tax authority in Nigeria, "I've shut down Mr. Adenuga's company." So they issued a press statement. This never showed up anywhere in our media. So it was possible for a single man to become so powerful that he even kept the government out of the public arena. So we were quite naturally outraged by this. And we decided we were going to publish it. Remember I said that this was virgin territory. We didn't have to do any real work, right? All we did in this case was to say, the tax authorities say this man refuses to pay $1.5 billion by his own admission. And that, as a result, we shut down his office. This became a huge thing. And he started pressuring us to try and stop us from publishing the story. And as his demands, expectations were lowered, as he realized that we were rather stubborn and foolish and perhaps self-destructive, he finally said, "Okay, then we're no longer going to do business with you." I said I was very sorry to hear that, but that we were still going to go ahead and publish the story. And the next day, all the telecom ads, and the telecom sector in Nigeria is the biggest advertiser in newspapers and so on, were withdrawn. Ads from his banks were withdrawn, and ads from anyone who did business with any of his businesses, and there were many, many, were also denied. So that was the illustration of the second pressure point that we were getting from the business elite. Now, as for the political elite, there was a different set of problems. There was, of course, competition amongst them. So long as we were doing something that injured, a friend of my friend or enemy of my enemy is my friend. So if we were the enemy of somebody's enemy, we were their friends for that moment until they vanquished their enemy and then they became our enemy. One of the more outlandish illustrations of that came when our then president, this was about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, he's been sickly for a while, and then he vanished ostensibly to go seek treatment in, of all places, Saudi Arabia. So while he was gone, he was supposed to be gone for a week or two, then it was a month, then it was 60 days, then it was 70 days, 75, 80 days. Nothing was being said. Now, this is a country of 150 million people smack in the heart of Africa. The president vanished and nobody was saying anything. So again, we said, to hell with it. So we started looking at what was really going on, and we established that the president was, in fact, terminally ill, and that all the instructions and things that had been emanating from the presidency were actually from his wife and a small cabal of aides who had effectively seized power and were trying to run the country from the shadows. So we just, in our usual foolishness, went hard into this and had a big headline in the Sunday edition. I believe this was January 10, 2010. Yar'Adua is brain damaged. It was a big headline right across this big broadsheet. And then we began to detail exactly what was wrong with the man and that he wasn't going to come back. So, of course, up until this time, what had been going on was that his wife, who was not an elected official and had no right to be running the country from the shadows or from the sunlight, was preventing the vice president, who was constitutionally required to step in the absence of the president, from doing so. We didn't know the vice president from Adam, or Eve, for that matter. And we were just fighting on the principle that if the Constitution says this is what should happen in the event that the president is indisposed, then it should happen. We had no idea whether I was a good person or a bad person, but at least let's get to the idea, the simple idea of following the law. So when the story came out, again, this was a big political explosion. The vice president and his supporters and the people from his area and so on were all very pleased with Next. And we became heroes to them, and we were summoned for private meetings and how big a service we were doing for the country. Now, Mr. Jonathan, Good Luck Jonathan is his name. He just won a proper election. I don't know a country whose president is named Good Luck Jonathan, except Nigeria. We haven't been shown to have much luck with him either. And we are now regarded as enemies of Mr. Jonathan because, naturally, we've been looking at what they've been up to lately. And this has led us into the heart of darkness in Nigeria, which is the oil industry. So we've been publishing, since the middle of the elections in April, a series of stories, vastly documented, demonstrating the degree of thievery and the casual lack of regard for even minimal propriety in the petroleum ministry run by a rather beautiful 50-year-old woman who is also widely believed to be the president's girlfriend and who is also widely believed to be hated with passion by the president's wife, perhaps understandably. And so we started publishing the stories about the malfeasance in the oil industry. They were really crass and rather dramatic. There wasn't any attempt at concealment or any degree of sophistication that was apparent from the way they were stealing. It would be something like if you were an oil marketing company and you needed the permission of the ministry to bring in some refined petroleum products and so on, you will get a letter authorizing you to do so. They will allocate how many metric tons you could bring in. And as you go for your letter, then they say, well, this is your letter. You've been approved for 100,000 tons for the next 3 months. However, you need to call this number, and whoever answers the phone, you pay them $8 per ton of your allocation, and when we get proof that you've paid, then you come and collect your letter. So it was that simple. So, of course, there are about 36 companies involved. At least five people from each of the companies will be aware of this transaction, because you have to move money, you have to call people, and so on. So let's just say, conservatively, five people will be involved. Five times 36. You could not keep a secret in the Catholic Church, even, if you had such large numbers of people involved. And so, naturally, one, two, or three called us, they gave us the numbers, our reporters called the number, a gentleman on the other end answers, they said, well, we've been asked to call this number so that we can pay you. How much shall we pay? He said, why are you asking me? You know it's $8 per ton, just bring the cash in these duffel bags to this address. So our reporters arranged to meet with him, and they went there, they recorded everything. Of course, they didn't have any money to give him, so they made up a story that the guy bringing the cash, his flight was delayed or whatever. So they still met him and recorded the video. Now, a funny thing happened. I had gone into this story to illustrate the particular challenge that we faced. A funny thing happened. Everyone who had my telephone number, or so it seemed to me, on the night before we printed the story and posted it on the web, was calling me. Ministers, old primary school friends from 45 years ago, the head of the State Petroleum Company, other newspaper publishers, saying, you can't do this. And I remember in particular a fellow publisher called me and he said, you're just going to throw $20 million away. This story is worth $20 million to you. So we also sort of laughed about it. But he was actually not joking, because the money was in fact offered to prevent the story from being published. When it was clear that we were not going to do any such thing, I started getting calls from my directors, from my shareholders, who also, you know, had interests that will require friendship with the government from time to time. So our carefully constructed arrangement began to fall apart, because by the time that my directors, my shareholders became terrified now, finally, of what we were doing, we got to the limits of how much bleeding you were willing to experience. Everybody has a threshold for pain. We are now bumping hard against that. And so what has happened is we are broke. We're losing some of our brightest young people who have to pay rent after all. We are denied business. My key shareholders and close friends have developed cold feet and they disappeared. We're having trouble getting everyone to agree to in the next board meeting and all these kinds of things. And basically, what made it even more disappointing, I think, finally, was that we put all of this thing in the public arena. And this gets to my final point. And nothing happened. I was just telling Ethan and Colin when we were having a conversation before we came over to this room that in what amounted to the giving of the middle finger to us, the petroleum minister has just been reconfirmed as minister by the Senate without as much as a single question being asked. So I started naturally asking myself, what if you arm the public with information and they refuse to act? What then? Nobody is in the streets demonstrating or crying foul or insisting that this woman needs to go. We've published all the source documents. It was not speculative in any way. These things were all carefully documented and incontrovertible. But nothing has happened. So I'm going through the... is it the Valley of the Shadow of Death or the Shadow of the Valley of Death? I'm a lapsed Christian, so I forget some of these things. Getting to the point where you're asking, okay, we are faced with two choices, really. One is to stubbornly continue at the age of 50 and look for other ways, change our business model, do something else, or just say, to hell with it. We've already made our statement. Let me go back to my daughters and try and be a father to them, right? And maybe come to the Berkman Center and pontificate for a little while, which may not be such a bad thing. But it's a very important question that I think we should all apply our minds to. What if you provide the information? What if you take the risk? What if you did all the reporting? What if you were broke in the process? Which is a lot better than being shot at or tortured by the people that you were showing. We haven't got to that yet. Threats have been issued, but have not been carried out, I suspect, because they found they could give us the middle finger and continue the way they've been going. If we were actually stopping them, if we were having any impact, maybe our lives would be more readily in danger. Right now, it's just secondary threats and so on. Nobody has ever actually put a gun to my head. Hopefully, we can keep it that way. But the question has to be asked, what if you did all this and armed the public with the information that they need to enable them to take rational decisions as citizens, and they don't? So maybe you can help me with that. Thank you.
Rather than let Dele walk off the stage with a provocation like that one, I want to bring our two speakers up here and just open up questions for a couple of minutes. We've got two utterly extraordinary journalists here, and I just wanted to give anyone a chance to raise any questions, or even beyond questions, helpful thoughts. How do we move beyond just sharing this sort of information, and how do we get to the point where we have impact? And I don't have a roving mic, so I'm going to call on people and just stand up and yell out a question.
You can try the mic.
Press the button. Yeah, there you go.
Okay. I wanted to ask the last speaker, do you think that your news reporting did not have the desired effect because it reached only people who read newspapers and was not retransmitted by other media to people who don't read newspapers?
Well, I'm sorry to say that we actually have a rather robust website, and we probably have the highest traffic of any news website in Nigeria. In fact, when we started out, our first professionally produced piece of information went out on Twitter. This was in December 4, 2008. 2 weeks later, we launched the website, 234next.com, and 2 weeks after that, we had our first print edition, the weekend paper. So we are doing this on every platform we can get our hands on.
Well, can I clarify? Is it that you're only reaching people who read through any media these stories, people who are getting their news from radio and television? Is your story being retransmitted through those media?
No.
And is that the problem?
It's possible, but I suspect not. I mean, maybe, okay, instead of having 2 million people, maybe we will have 20, right? But even the 2 million are not doing anything. And these are the most privileged, the most active, the most educated segment of society. Now, the point I think that is very important from what you're saying is that we're alone. That's really the issue. A lot of the stories that we've done are supposed to create a furore in the public, and all the other newspapers and radio stations and TV should be jumping all over it. But nobody does. I think I mentioned earlier that I even offered to share these documents with some of the publishers and other news organizations. But when a place is so corrupt that money trumps all, it's possible for you to become very isolated. Which was so dramatically illustrated in the example of the business baron who was able to shut the government out of the public arena. It's that serious.
Right. See, it seems to me that you guys, are very focused on providing credible reporting and doing a lot of investigative journalism, something that's very honorable and great. But I guess it's difficult. I mean, how do you deal with the tension of having information and then maybe the temptation of framing it in such a way that could be so sensational and polarizing to get people to act. Because sometimes, if you just give the information, you know, as information without the right sensational framing, it doesn't have the same impact. But then also, you know, you don't want to be involved in just sensationalism and outright, you know, polarization, right? So.
Well, I was saying to Ethan this afternoon that maybe we haven't found the right language for engaging the public. But I don't come from the spoon-feeding school. Maybe I'm just the wrong person to be leading an enterprise. I presume that people are rational and that in most cases they will act in their own best interests, and that really my job is to place the information before them and hope that they'll take it and use it as a basis for acting. I'm not a sociologist, but it's clearly that assumption is incorrect. So I'll try and learn new tricks as an old dog, maybe, and maybe we can find other means. But I'm doing the best I can for what I know.
So let's put that towards Fatima. How do you deal with this question of how do you tell these sensational and awful stories without sort of falling into sensationalism, which can be deeply polarizing, as Amir is pointing
out.
But
it can also drive people to action.
So what's that balance around sensationalism? How do we look at that?
That's a very good question, actually. You have to deal with the idea that your report can endanger someone's life. And sensational is not the most important thing you can tell. Even in a very, quiet whisper, you can say something that can drive people to act. And those actions actually happen. For example, 3 days ago, I received a call from Caucasus. The people were... they came to protest against torture and extrajudicial killings. And they blocked the highway. It continued. It was about 1,500 young people. I interviewed some of them right at the place, and I couldn't report about it because I did not have any confirmation from official side. Next morning, I interviewed the Ministry of that Republic. He confirmed the information. I interviewed the. Member of the parliament of Russia, he confirmed the information. But what happened was the situation is so tense, so the local police was not allowed to deal with this issue. The whole meeting was surrounded by the federal troops, by the heavy tanks and all that stuff, and they were pushed out from the road. And you know, you never know where is the border. Sometimes I think this social apathy or apathy, how do you say that?
Apathy.
The
yeah.
Social apathy is kind of a survival instinct for the people in the Caucasus. You saw this story of this, you know, old man. He did nothing. It was a social protest, a very peaceful one. That's why I think there is a huge, big need for international engagement in the situation, and it works. For example, if you have heard about this Magnitsky Law, which the Congress of the United States is about to approve, they created a special list of people who violate the human rights in Russia, the authorities, and that works. Immediately, the case of Magnitsky was reviewed and they started solving it. For more than 5 years, nothing happened. And as soon as the United States announced, this Congress announced this development about, you know, the Magnitsky Law, the Russian prosecutor office suddenly investigated the case, yeah, that was never investigated properly. So this kind of pressure is needed, and it works.
David?
Ethan,
you and Persephone both were very, very interested in why people don't pay attention, don't care about stories about people who are not like them in some sense. But we now have heard two really fascinating presentations of cultures in which people are not caring about people like them. We certainly have this cross-cultural thing. Is it possible, do you think, that what you're concerned is actually a subset of a larger way in which people don't care, even about people who are like them?
David, let me first say that you're breaking our rules of the road here, and I'm moderating these two speakers. So, you know, when you throw the question to the moderator, you know, things get a little messy. But look, so a lot of the work that's been done on media attention focuses on this very basic human factor, homophily, the tendency of birds of a feather to flock together. And the idea that we're more likely to pay attention to the stories of our people, our tribe, those who are most like us. What I think is so incredibly valuable about having our two friends with us today is it's a reminder that that's not the only thing that can get in the way of us paying attention. And I've spent a good chunk of today with Dele, and one of the things that I think we're finding, and I wouldn't be surprised to hear that this is true with Yorick as well, Fatima, is that the inability to do anything, or the perception that you're unable to do anything, turns out to be the best impetus towards disinterest, right? So hearing a difficult story that you are completely powerless to do anything about is a bummer. You know, it's a downer. You get all moved by it. You know, you really want to do something. I mean, maybe you want to head towards the Caucasus. Maybe you want to head towards Nigeria. I'm sort of torn somewhere between the two.
You want to head towards the bar.
And instead, you head towards the bar. And one of the things that I think is sort of now coming into play as we're all confronting these problems, how do you overcome cynicism? The answer may actually be a very non-journalistic answer. It may not be enough just to report this, it may require you to both report and then invite action of one fashion or another. I don't know if that's true in your thinking about the Caucasus.
Yeah, actually, I was struggling, trying to remain professional and not to become a human rights activist. When you report on those atrocities and you see people struggling and, there's no law for the government, and every law works, in the severe way for the people. So, from that environment, you have to. You became passionate. You became involved, and that's a danger for the journalists. Maybe it's not a danger. That's a question for me. If it is a danger, or you have to become passionate. I don't know, it's a big question, I think, and also I always think these people live in this beautiful country peacefully, they have their government who respects in many sense their lives, their rights. Why should they care about my small place and my people getting killed or their rights violated? And sometimes I think if you give up even the small piece, you give up the whole universe. The idea of human rights is universal, and the freedom also is universal. And if you give up, and if you allow some government to violate a small people, then you will be facing problems in the future, because, you know, it's like a virus. So I don't think it can be ignored.
Thank you. Just want to introduce myself quickly. I'm Khadija. On Twitter, I'm KMB Tweets, and I'm here in a room with a lot of people that I worship on the internet. So, and one of the reasons I got on Twitter was Persephone, actually. She recommended that I check it out. So this means a lot for me to be here. I just wanted to say one of the things that you brought up for me was that more information is not always better. And my example comes from Nigeria. I actually wrote my thesis about the house arrest of Moshoda Abiola and the assassination of his wife, I actually came to the conclusion that he also was assassinated, though slightly more slowly. And what was interesting was that the fact that it was repressed in the media around the world actually led activists here to be more fervent, more passionate, and more organized. We knew that we could get people killed if we spoke out too carelessly. We knew we could get people killed if we did things wrong, if we took one slight misstep. And we understood the danger. We also understood that he wasn't a pure guy, you know, that he had his own business affiliations that were pretty interesting. And, you know, so, but what it did was it created a small movement of expats from Nigeria here in Cambridge. It created an intense interest among journalists at the Christian Science Monitor, which actually then led to a little niche of journalists at the New York Times, and a sort of international movement slowly built. So I guess I would speak to this, the kind of hopelessness that I also share. I'm a newbie publisher, so I sometimes I stare in the mirror and go, what the hell are you doing? But, you know, I think that we have to remember that these things are slow and they're cyclical, and that people sometimes surprise you and get really passionate about something just at the moment when you think everything's just fallen apart, that you just, you know, right when you give up hope, right when you're in the shadow of the valley of death, then I don't know the exact wording either. Sorry, but I do want to say, though, that another thing that it, the kind of opposite effect thing that can happen is a friend of mine is here. He's a journalist from Libya who I cannot name. He said that once the West stepped in, the approval rating for Gaddafi went up from negligible to nearly 80%. So sometimes telling the story, getting the word out to the West, is not necessarily in your best interest for the movement. So this idea that more information is always better, I just want to remind us all in this room to think about the kind of larger socio-political implications of getting the story out, and what do we do, and when do we choose it. And that is a human rights thing. That is taking away the view from nowhere. It's kind of taking us out of what we, and I also consider to be a traditional journalistic role, and putting us into more of an activist role. And we have to think about that. It's a big question. It's one I'm grappling with as well.
I just want to take one other question from Nasser Wedede and then give both of you guys the chance to respond to that great observation and also to Nasser's question.
Thank you. What is fascinating just sitting here and listening to your stories, I know this subject has been beaten to death, but just bear with me for a second. That sentiment of hopelessness, in absolute apathy and rejection from the public opinion, was very much the norm and the standard in the Middle East and North Africa. And we spent years, I'm not going to say, people in that field spent years just grappling with that that issue, putting out information and struggling, and yet nothing happening. Well, it seems that...
You're fine.
And
just talk.
Yeah. So I don't. I'm very loud by nature.
Maybe turn on your microphone and just push it forward.
We can hear Nasser. This is not a problem. Amplifying his voice is not usually my main, you know, difficulty.
And yet, at some point there was a conceptual breakthrough. And information all of a sudden mattered. And I mean, just sitting here and listening to your stories, by the way, I lived in Nigeria, I know exactly, we were diplomats entering the airport, Murtala Muhammad, and yet they asked us for a 20-naira bribe just to let us in. And the point that I was kind of struggling with, even though sometimes a lot of folks, when they hear me talk, they think that I'm trying to pound on journalists. Actually, some of my best friends are journalists, and I spend my time with journalists. But, you know, at times you have to drop. Sometimes there are extraordinary situations call for extraordinary solutions. Sometimes when human lives are being lost or entire nations' fortunes and futures are being squandered, one might be tempted to say, hey, drop the pretense. Who cares? Who cares if the principles of journalism are being are being abided by or not. But that, because at the end of the day, this is an informational warfare. And you already engaged yourself and put your line on the net. So why don't you go the extra yard and follow through?
So this is a great, I think, pair of questions to turn to our friends to react to. Basically, where's this line between journalism and activism? Because in many ways, the very act of saying, let's tell stories that are underrepresented, is an activist action. How do we navigate that as journalists?
There's the only one way to remain a journalist and also to call for action. You don't have to call, actually. Your purpose is to tell the story, to check the facts, to represent the story as it is. Not try to raise your voice or try to make it more attractive than it is. I believe the stories that I tell are, by nature, they are already, some of them even horrible. So as a bug becoming a human rights activist, sometimes as a journalist you need to go to the conferences and talk about violences you witnessed. And sometimes you talk about the violences that you have experienced by yourself. I mean, yourself from the government and the government-affiliated agencies. So I think this is a time, and I thought about it a lot of times, and we spoke about it with my fellow journalists. We never came to the conclusion that if you are a journalist, you have to be a robot. You don't have to, you have to abandon all your feelings. You have to shut off your heart and your judgment and just take, be blind and go on one line. It's impossible. You are a human being. You see what is right and what is wrong. However you try to be, cool-headed, doesn't matter. You try to be objective and you are just a mirror. Just tell the story that helps, in my opinion. That's what I do. I get involved. I have a huge burden of survivor guilt because sometimes I feel that I told the stories of those people who really suffer from torture, from all this. And that's how that's my profession. And then I think, I exploited those people, if you think philosophically or from other point of view. And then where is the morality for me? So journalism is all burden, and you just have to deal with this. I'm sorry, I was too long.
Well, just very briefly, I think more to your point, I think there is great value in calm rationality and fact-checking and balance and not waging a campaign against a person or a group or an institution. Principally because we already have more than enough of the other side. We have bloggers and activists and rants, and the internet is filled with all sorts of junk, right? There is room for a rational consideration of things presented, provided as dispassionately as possible. Otherwise, we're all screaming. As to whether there are times you consider that information is too much and so on, well, I mean, what we do, and I think she just very eloquently described it, could be very morally compromising, right? I have had to make a decision, and this is something of a confession here, but since you're all tweeting and all of that, I won't put names to it. But there has been a couple of times when I'd ordered that information be withheld. I'm not absolutely sure I was correct. You were just measuring things. It actually involved a rather effective and very passionate and, patriotic even, public official who's done a lot of good things and had fought the establishment and so on. Rather shocking to the public that such a thing would come from a public official in Nigeria. Then we found that he did a few things that were perhaps not as kosher, that maybe he shouldn't have done, something that he wouldn't be proud if his daughter found out and so on. And I said, on the scale of things, just leave this alone, because the potential damage was too severe to the system and to, you know, what we perceive to be the good that he was doing, right? Now, it wasn't a case of stealing and stuff like that. It was more what some would call a moral failure and stuff. I thought that was not that relevant, so you withhold the information. Now, maybe many people in this room will say I did the right thing. Some might say I didn't. I'm not absolutely sure myself. So there are always times that you do that. But generally, I'm on the side of releasing information rather than withholding it. There are exceptional circumstances, and hopefully they will be truly exceptional.
So I just want to get a round of applause to thank these two extraordinary individuals. So something that I think has become clear in a number of people's comments and even in the questions is that Persephone had an incredible gift for connecting people who were passionate about the same issues that she was passionate about. And our next speaker is actually someone who I went to school with. I lived in the same town of 8,000 people with for 2 years. Who dated a dear friend of mine and who I never met until Persephone tried to find me the new executive director of Global Voices, which turned out to be the smartest hire I've ever made in my entire life. So a dear friend of Persephone's, a colleague at Internews, the man who means that I don't have to worry about Global Voices 24/7, and a man who knows an extraordinary amount about Afghanistan and Pakistan, which is actually the specific reason that we asked Ivan Sigal to come to the stage, because the next round, announced in April, of the Persephone Meal Fellowships are focusing on three extraordinary Pakistani journalists who are doing their best to unpack what's going on in that country. So we wanted to ask Ivan to come to the stage and tell us a bit more about the background.
Good evening. I like the desk perches that we have here. It's a really great way to present. It makes me feel like I'm at home, sitting at my coffee table. So I want to talk a little bit, before getting into Pakistan, I want to talk a little bit about the question that's kind of been reverberating tonight about attention, about media attention, and how we choose or how we're able to, what decisions we drive us to make to analyze or look at or follow specific stories. And I think one strand that's really come out of the talk thus far is how do we actually enable ourselves to follow international stories or amplify those stories when it's barely possible to tell them at a national level? That question encapsulates the work that Persephone did over a 15-year period, starting in Russia and then onward to the Berkman Center. And Persephone had two strands of her work that I think lead me to a place of understanding the way she perceived the world, and that I want to share with you tonight. And they lie at the level of structure and the level of personal engagement. So one aspect of Persephone's work, in the place that I first met her in Moscow in 1996, had to do with creating and sustaining structures for media to exist and for people to operate independently and fearlessly within their own communities and societies, to tell stories, to do so from a basis of financial independence and from a basis of the creating a sort of a social web or network whereby people could share and feel confident that their work was going to be falling into a space of engagement with their communities. So focusing on people who owned and controlled their own television and radio stations, people who had the capacity and the resilience to compete in their own societies for a voice. And that was the work that she did throughout Russia, throughout the former Soviet Union. But the second aspect of her work was that everything that Persephone did in her daily engagement was personal, was deeply personal, so that the people that she engaged with were never just sociological in character. They were always individuals. And I think that's a really important question when you're thinking about the idea of attention. Because for Persephone, the choice to engage in a question or engage in an issue was, I think, always foremost. It was personal before it was philosophical or rational. And the idea that we have communities or tribes, to me, that's always been a little bit wrong, because we can create our own tribes. The world has changed drastically in the last 20 years, and we expect it will continue to do so. And Persephone's goal and her gift was to reach out and to create networks that allowed us, or helped us, and helped me, certainly, to expand my perception of what it was that was important to me. And I think that, in a sense, that's a long and slow task. How is it that I will build a community of people whereby something that happens, you know, in Nigeria that last week meant nothing to me, next week means something to me? It's because I've met Dele, and now I care about Nigeria. Or I've come up with a way of engaging another part of the world that formerly didn't mean something to me. It was only an abstraction, now it's personal. And that way of engaging the world, I like its scale. I like that we work from the personal to the personal rather than from the ideological to the ideological. And this question of media attention so often falls into the realm of the ideological. And I'd like us to think very much about that personal level. So I worked with Persephone starting in 1996, and the question of that eventually became the Pulitzer Prize was something that drove her thinking about her work from the time that I first met her. I mean, I can remember 10 years ago we designed a television program before internet was what was now possible, if internet was possible, whereby we would link American journalists to international journalists who were working locally and try to tell stories from, say, rural Russia or rural Asia or cities and towns in other parts of the world, to try to build bridges that were personal between two different journalists and have them present a story to an audience that in such a way that it would create a dynamic that would be of interest to a community that people didn't know about. And that was a project that was based on a mass media structure, and it didn't ever work because it required a lot of capital and it required a lot of resources in a time of mass media. Persephone's time here helped her to analyze and engage the question of how information flows through networks. And I think the ideas that eventually became the Pulitzer Center award, her last wish, are reflective of that, of a kind of a solution to this question of the personal to the personal that could be built at a scale that was not did not require a mass media and a mass medium, but still had links to it. I'm going to address briefly Pakistan, and actually, you know what? I think, John, I'm going to have you come and talk a little bit about the Pulitzer Prize at this point, and then we'll get into Pakistan, because I'll ask you to talk a little bit about India as well, and together we'll do that, because I think this is the right time for that. Yeah, so come on up. So this is John Sawyer, who is the executive director of the Pulitzer Center. The Pulitzer Center is a fabulous project that focuses on getting information, American journalists to cover international issues that are scarcely or poorly covered about crisis and conflict in the United States. I'll just wait, sign up.
Thank you, Ivan. I was very struck by Deli's comment about the challenge of starting something new at 50. And I started the Pulitzer Center at the age of 54. And there have been many, many times in the last 6 years that I thought, God, if I'd only started this when I was 50. So you don't know what a young, lucky guy you are. It is such an honor to be part of this program, to be with this group, especially to be with Persephone's family and friends. As you've heard, we've discussed, I mean, Persephone had a way of inspiring and one thing, you know, leading to another, and that was very much the case in our experience with her. Fatima, Persephone was very important in bringing Fatima to us several years ago, and it was the experience that of our working with Fatima that gave Persephone the idea that maybe there'd be an opportunity for fellowships such as the one that Fatima had had. And so we created the idea, we talked and we worked with InterNews and Ivan and others, Persephone's family, to create the Persephone Mill Fellowship through the Pulitzer Center. And we were able last fall, summer and fall, to raise about $50,000, which was a great, great start. And the idea was that we would have at least one fellowship every year of $7,500 for a journalist who had no access to the international media market to be able to tell stories, to reach the international market on stories about his or her own country. So we put out a call for proposals late last fall. We had 170 applications from all over the world, really wonderful applications. And we decided in going through them that there were such strong applications, such strong proposals, and the idea of the Persephone Mill Fellowship was so important in itself that we decided to have not one but three initial Persephone Mill Fellows. And we used $7,500 from that $50,000 fund, and then we committed another $15,000 from our own funds outside of the Persephone Mill Fellowship, but called all three of them Persephone Mill Fellows. And we also were struck, and we chose one, and then we decided that we had three very strong proposals from the Indian subcontinent and Pakistan, and so we chose three from that area, thinking that this might lead to some synergies in the reporting and some cross connections among them as we were promoting them and leading to discussion. One of the things that we do at the Pulitzer Center is we work a lot with high schools and universities across the country and through the web to engage people in these issues through our journalism. And anytime that we can make connections across country, across themes, it's really helpful to us. And so we thought it was an opportunity to do that. So I just want to say briefly who we chose and what's happening with the reporting. The three journalists, Tariq Mir is an Indian journalist, and he's focusing on Kashmir, on the conflict between Sufi Muslims and Salafist and Wahhabi Muslims in Kashmir, and the repercussions of that for the Indian-Pakistan tensions in that region. Shivam Vij is another Indian journalist and is working on continuing issues of caste in that country. And lastly, Marvez Khan, who is writing under the name Shaheen Benari, and he is a Pakistani journalist who worked for Radio Free Europe in Prague, but with this grant he was back in Pakistan and especially in the Swat Valley this May and has been doing reports. His are the first reports of these three that have begun to come out on the Pulitzer Center, and he actually did a piece last Friday or Saturday on the harassment and murder of journalists in Pakistan, a very strong call for action and denunciation of the Pakistani government for what's been done and not been done. It's on our website. We expect to see a lot more of this in the next few weeks from these projects, and we'll begin the next round of applications in late fall this year for next year's fellows. And we couldn't be more excited about this. It's another thing about Persephone's continuing influence in this. Deli was talking about the work in Nigeria, and we've just launched another project that's a collaborative reporting project it's all about this issue of how do you get people to engage in issues far away and see connections here. And I think very much this is an extension of the Persephone kind of idea, the networking, the creation of personal networks across country that Ivan was talking about. And in the case of the West African initiative, it's an extension of our work on water and sanitation issues, but we've recruited a team of four West African journalists representing different media platforms, And they're working with Steve Sapienza, who is an American journalist who's done a lot of work with us and with NewsHour on water and sanitation issues. And the five of them, plus our staff, will work together this fall and do reporting on sustainability and accountability issues and on the issue of access to clean water and sanitation, why so much money has been spent with so little long-term effect in that sector. And we hope by having a platform on NewsHour, if this all goes as planned, and then our website and NewsHour's website and the other partners that we have, that we will draw American attention, international media attention, to the great reporting that we expect to get out of the Nigerian and the Liberian and the journalists from the other two countries that are working with us on this project, and we'll create a platform where they can continue to report on that issue. So it's that kind of thing. We didn't know, we've evolved in many, many ways at the Pulitzer Center in the last 6 years, but Persephone was one of the most influential people in our development, and she continues to influence us today. She's up. If you go to our website today, you'll see there's that wonderful picture of Persephone at the beach. It's on our homepage on the website today because the reporting has just begun from these Persephone Mill Fellows, and we very much feel her living presence in what we do. So thank you all.
So briefly, because we're almost done, but I want to highlight the importance of the Pakistani and the Indian stories for you, because if you notice the structure of American international media, we have a lot of international media, but it tends to be very focused, narrowly focused on one or two big stories. So you'll hear an awful lot about Pakistan. 4 years ago, 5 years ago, you heard an awful lot about Iraq, but you always hear that. You only hear those stories from one or two very specific perspectives. And when that story is in the news, you're not going to hear about much else. So if we hear about Pakistan in the United States, we're mostly hearing about drones, suicide bombing, and terror, and counter-terrorism activities. We are rarely hearing stories that are from the Pakistani perspective, and we're almost never hearing stories that are not coming out of the geopolitical framework or set of interests that is that defines the United States engagement in Pakistan. And there's a reason for that, and we can go into it. We generally know what that is. But if we fail to look beyond that, then we misunderstand or we miss a lot of essential ideas about that place. And Pakistan is an amazing crucible of both the Nigerian and the Caucasian experience in some ways, because it is as corrupt as Nigeria and as dangerous as the Caucasus. Pakistan last year had more journalists killed than any other country in the world for the work that they were doing. So 8 last year, already five journalists have been killed in Pakistan this year for the work that they were doing. Roughly 40 in the past decade. That's not all of the journalists killed in Pakistan. Probably close to 100 were killed in the last decade, but specifically that number for the work that they were doing. It's a tremendously dangerous place to work. There's an incredible amount of impunity in government behavior. Salim Shahzad is the latest victim in Pakistan. He was killed for reporting on... Shortly after he reported on an al-Qaeda attack on an airbase outside of Karachi. And his story is really fascinating because it's widely suspected that he was killed by the ISI. That in itself is not news. What's news is that the United States government actually came out last week, 2 or 3 days ago, and said we have evidence that he was killed by the ISI, which caused an international firestorm. So it is true, as we've heard, that sometimes international pressure does make a difference. But we don't expect that Pakistani governmental behavior will really change. I just like to point out that the resources and the possibility and the potential for us to listen to and read and hear stories that are coming from Pakistanis that are not primarily about the framework that the American media is placing on those stories or those kind of narrow channels that we're always seeing, especially on our cable television, is a tremendous one. And I urge you all to take the time to engage those stories both because they're different voices, but also personally. And I think if you do that, you'll be honoring the memory and the will and the passion of our dear friend Persephone. I'd like to introduce Tony Rudin, Persephone's husband and good friend, to close the evening.
The thing that strikes me over and over again is the breadth, the reach of Persephone's intelligence and care. Ivan talked about that everything she did was personal, and Ethan, you said that she was good at connecting up people who cared about the same things that she did, but she cared about so many things that we all felt like she was the one that we went to if we didn't know how to do something or if we needed to find the person who knew about whatever. And that thing, that everything she did was personal. She was so involved in so many things. While she was learning from everyone at Berkman, she was working with her mom on a book that her mom had written and that my sister helped publish. She was looking at pictures of her beloved niece. She was bugging her stepdaughters about what they were going to do the next summer. She was just involved in so many things. And so we all miss her in just so many different ways. And so
thanks, Tony.